This week's episode is brought to you by Jacob Cardinal, Mackenzie Kennedy, Lorna Garano, Jonathan Mills, Wisteria, and Unfuck the World. Thank you, Jacob Cardinal, Mackenzie Kennedy, Lorna Garano, Jonathan Mills, Wisteria, and Unfuck the World. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that helps keep our brave team of reality hackers jacked into the quantum mesh network of galactic subintelligence, where we illegally upload our episodes to be transmitted through the pan-dimensional relay so you can hear this episode comfortably from within your native timeline. If you'd like to help us keep transmitting to dimensions unknown, or just hear the second half of this show, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you access to the extended version of this episode, but every single one of our episodes going back before the Roaring Twenties even began. But that's not all. I'll send you a 5x5 high-quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, guaranteed to frighten your religious co-workers who are afraid of art. But not only that, I'll even send you the keys to our secret Discord server, where you can help us plan our rebellion against the Anunnaki overlords. If you enjoy the free section of the show, but would rather save your $5 for a deluxe camping spork, then please consider giving us a like, subscribe, or best of all, share an episode with a friend or on your social media platform of choice. We're a small podcast, so your contributions as such are strongly felt and appreciated. On this week's episode, we tackle a popular, albeit somewhat nebulous concept that, for the last few years, has become a regular topic of discussion for the spiritually inclined and conspiracy-themed content concerning the symbolic lineage of the Sumerian gods known as the Anunnaki and how their feud still endures with us caught in the crossfire. In the free section of the show, we discuss the Sumerian Garden of Eden myths, Noah's Flood, the Anunnaki brothers Enki and Enlil, alongside the warlike Eagle faction loyal to Enlil. In the extended version of the show, we discuss serpent faction ideology and the cults of both Eagle and Serpent faction while exploring how this battle of archetypes influenced early American history. Thank you, and enjoy the show. So, as you may have realized, I often start the show with bad jokes. But this week, I found a joke from ancient Sumeria. In fact, I found three. The first one comes from a 4,000-year-old stone tablet in Sumeria. So it's the oldest one. It reads, "A dog walks into a bar and says, 'I cannot see a thing.' I'll open this one."
What?
Nobody knows what it means.
So. What the f***?
Okay, this next one is from 3,000 years ago in Sumeria. "Something which has never occurred since time immemorial. The young woman did not fart in her husband's lap."
What? Heresy.
Am I missing the punchlines?
We're like a couple 10,000 years out of these.
It's saying that women fart and it's funny.
That last one was actually funny.
It's lying though. Everybody knows that girls don't fart.
It's true.
All right, this next one is from 1200 BC and it goes, "Three ox drivers from Adab were thirsty. One owned the ox, the other owned the cow, and the other owned the wagon's load. The owner of the ox refused to get water because he feared his ox would be eaten by a lion. The owner of the cow refused because he thought his cow might wander off into the desert. The owner of the wagon refused because he feared his load would be stolen. So they all went. In their absence, the ox made love to the cow, which gave birth to a calf, which ate the wagon's load. The problem? Who owns the calf?"
That's funny.
Whoa.
I'm like actually thinking about that.
It's all complicated to get to the end.
Yeah, I'm like that meme with the calculations.
Yeah, I'm doing that too.
All right. All of our goods got eaten up by this newborn that's half mine and half yours, I guess.
And fed on the others.
But yeah, it's not our wagon.
It's like, yeah, but okay, because it ate all of the stuff in the wagon, I feel like that the wagon guy should get the calf, because it's not like the ox or the cow disappeared. You know what I mean?
I think that's fair.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just bind the lesser gods into a lifetime of nonstop, backbreaking, soul-crushing physical labor to vivify the land so that we, the greater gods with the better cars, may lounge about eating bread and drinking wine. Nay, we decide to give the lesser gods a break and create a race of sentient pink meat robots who wear their private parts in the front and are born without even the ability to breathe through their nose or hold their heads up, so that if they do manage to somehow survive childhood, childhood, they can perform a daily routine of nonstop, backbreaking, soul-crushing physical labor for the duration of the rest of their short and significant lives, because this week, we're discussing the Sumerian Anunnaki creator gods, the rivalry between wise Enki and mighty Enlil, and the legacy of the rivalry which subsumes the whole of human history in a battle between the mimetic archetype of serpent versus the eagle. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, also known as the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the megavoltic moonbeam, Mari Sama.
Awoo!
The Martian Messiah, Melkor 5.
What up?
And my holy head-turning honey bun, Heka Astra.
Hello.
This week's episode was prepared once again by the loving care of our cherished collaborator, the mighty Mr. Tim Hacker, creator of the Crypto Chronicles podcast, www.cryptochronicles.com. Thank you again, Mr. Tim Hacker. We're so grateful to have you back again. I always look forward to these strange shows that you prepare for us.
Hell yeah.
I'd ask you how your personal life is going, but you won't tell us, so...
Haha, a mystery.
Yeah, it's a mystery, guys.
I heard he was like, you know, painting Warhammer.
Dude, but, I gotta be cryptic, bro. Okay, cryptic is in the name. I gotta be cryptic or otherwise I'm being fake. And then definitely painting hella Warhammer.
So for this episode, we're discussing not just a big topic, one that slithers through the realm of conspiracy theory, religion, and even the origins of humanity, but best of all, one that has swooped into being a popular idea in places where these topics are regularly discussed. For instance, I know I've heard at least Sam Tripoli and Greg Carlwood playfully repping an allegiance to the side of the serpent, which, by the end of this episode, you probably will be too. That being said, the problem with this topic also happens to be its strength. It threatens to take all of human history, alongside its complex tapestry of religions, mythologies, and spiritual perspectives, put them in a box with some shiny wrapping paper, put a nice little bow on top of all of it, and hand it to you and say, this is the whole picture. But with any luck, this episode will be unpacking this giant gift box, diving inside and inspecting what its contents are, gifts from heaven, and how much of it is foam-packing peanuts, and then maybe how much of it is just plain nuts altogether. That being said, a good bit of the information from this show comes from Matthew Lacroix, who has authored many books and lectures on this specific topic, and we're going to be going ahead and mixing in some scholarly research to round out the flavor, for those of you with hungry brain syndrome.
I should also mention that one of my sources for this episode is Reinstall Paul, who was a past guest on The Whole Rabbit. I believe the episode was called Encrypted Wisdom, if you want to check it out. But he has a whole series on YouTube talking about the eagle and the serpent, and he goes in depth on his own points that he thinks are relevant, and we're going to just kind of bring our version of it.
That being said, it seems like the specifics of this topic can sometimes be a little questionable, but if you zoom out, the overall idea does have some teeth, and that's why you see so many commentators and personalities who will entertain it in a general format. And so we're going to be kind of exploring like where the rubber meets the road and just where we're spinning our wheels.
Yeah, and it's interesting you brought it up, how you can take a look at all of human history from the scope of this topic we're going to get into. And, you know, dare I say, and you can say this any day in the future too, it's super relevant to what's going on right now.
There's definitely some weird coincidences, yeah.
It's always going to be that way because this is a problem that humans have had since we've been humans. It's far older than Western civilization itself, but its overall meaning is the very thing that will destroy Western civilization, like for sure.
So what might be some differences, similarities, and understanding that modern people have compared to the ancients when it comes to these animals?
I guess some of the obvious points about these two animals that we understand that the ancients knew, right? No, an eagle's a bird, which means they fly. We all know this.
Scorpio.
And they're also associated with Scorpio. Yeah, you'll oftentimes see them swapped in the zodiac.
Or even in pentagram rituals, when you're invoking in the quadrant of Scorpio, you oftentimes are told to draw an eagle's head.
Could be the stinger of a scorpion. Pecks and pokes.
Looks like a talon.
You know, versus the idea of a snake. And a snake, of course, is kind of stuck to the ground and doesn't get anywhere near the sky.
Unless it's a dragon.
True. So for the sake of this episode, these facts about the two creatures, one flying and one on the ground, they're at first symbolic in that way. And this is a lot of the traits that occultists and philosophers have played with when they're using these symbols in the past. And we see these on military flags because they're very effective for these reasons. One could combat the other. And like I said, this is an ancient problem humans have had in our survival on this planet. So why not use this archetype as a symbol?
They're a little bit like fire and water. One starts low and then moves upward. One starts up high and then moves downward, which may be why Scorpio, a water sign, could be associated with the eagle who dives down from the sky, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. So to take it a step further into some of the message of what these animals symbolize, the eagle is an emblem of the higher human, a bit of a metaphor for humanity's desire to break away from nature, or at least break from the natural state that we are kind of just dropped into when we enter this life. And there's a lot of wisdom in that. So the serpent, in regards to what I just mentioned, the serpent is symbolic of the lower human, or the animal mind. Now, this isn't necessarily a bad thing either. This archetype is very receptive and is concerned with the fundamentals that underline what it means to be a human in the first place. After all, the serpent is one big sensory organ. It's able to sense a wide range of information or different things in its environment that are too subtle for any other archetype to detect. There's a lot of wisdom to be found in this endeavor as well. Some snakes can actually see like in almost complete darkness because they have infrared. It's kind of crazy.
In some sense, these two animals are a little bit like the formula of the Sphinx. Of course, the eagle and the falcon can be cognate, but so can the snake and the cat, because the cat is also a very sensitive, earthbound, whole body is a sensory organ type animal. And I think the ancients could see that very clearly.
Cats might even be better. There's just a different constellation that's a cat in the sky, so they couldn't use it again.
They're both creatures that stalk primates inside of trees. You know what I mean? Like, you gotta be on the lookout if you're a primate for either of these two creatures. And they can both be kind of colorful and sneaky.
So these descriptions paint a very clear picture of how these two animals are seemingly opposite forces in our world. So to take a little bit of a sidestep, I always like to bring up etymology whenever I can. And I never thought to ever look up the word eagle. Surprisingly, the origin of the word is not quite clear. Its direct origin word we do know. It's the Latin word aquilus, which means dark or black bird. And it's interesting to note that the word aquilus did eventually just mean black in some context.
Okay, and just FYI, the aquila from Anatolia, it's called the aquila, and that's the double-headed eagle. You see it a lot in eagle factions.
I'm pretty sure Kanye West put that symbol on his new clothing lineup.
You see it in the tarot, too.
It's also on tons of coats of arms, possibly some flags and yep. Family crests and whatnot.
Yep, the aquila is very common. It depends on who you ask what it means. One of the heads is looking towards the future and the other head is looking towards the past is a lot of the what people think, but it could be anything.
And some researchers claim that perhaps the Romans got the word from aqua or water. Some criticism does exist of that analysis, though, because they just don't understand how you would extract the word black with water. And I've seen black water many times, so I don't know what they're talking about when they're saying that.
Yeah, I don't know what they're talking about either. It's pretty obvious, the connection.
Yeah. So considering the whole idea of the primordial waters also being a somewhat of a chaotic black void, I think there's definitely something going on there.
Absolutely. Once again, to bring up the Scorpio association in the Hermetic arts, Scorpio is fixed water. So it's still, and that would be associated with the abyss, at least in my opinion. It's dark water.
And, you know, this is the chaos that Leviathan in the Bible existed in. And we have snakes and all kinds of other mythologies that are associated with this. Like, there's a long, very long list. But then you look at the etymology of snake, and it basically just means to creep. And they do have like the original Proto-Indo-European word for it. And not as controversial, I guess. But it means to creep. It definitely means something sneaky and calm and waiting.
Sneaky, sneaky snake.
Patience.
So before we get into the whole alien creator being family feud bit, we're going to take a look at the different civilizations or specifically cults which venerated these two animals to kind of check their temperature and see if their characteristics match up with the larger story that we're about to tell. So just to pick one out of the hat. Here in the Americas, in the not-too-distant past, we had the Eagle Knights of the Aztec culture, the most skilled and feared of all the Aztec fighting forces. Being an Eagle Knight, or a Cuauhtli, was one of the greatest honors a person could hold and served as a means of attaining the social status of a noble regardless of one's class at birth. So you had a little bit of mobility going on if you could become one. If you did become an Eagle Knight, that meant you could drink pulque, a tequila sort of concoction that if you drank it outside of the wrong class or if you were too young, they would just put you to death. So it was a big privilege. You could also keep concubines, and you had the privilege of dining at the royal palace. So kind of a big deal. Then you even got to dress, and during combat no less, as a big fly-ass eagle, replete with feathers woven in from head to toe, and then topped with an open-mouthed eagle helmet adorned with authentic eagle feathers. Eagle knights were equipped with atlatl, which is essentially a giant Mesoamerican lawn dart. They had obsidian spears, daggers, and the uniquely Aztec macuahuitl, which was a sort of tapered, rectangular club with long obsidian blades embedded along the side. So it would hurt really, really bad if they hit you with one of those.
Very brittle, but razor sharp.
Eagle Knights were also known to fling flaming rocks called firestones at enemies using woolen slings. Likewise, many of the Eagle Warriors' weapons were designed to maim, stun, and immobilize the opponent because being a good warrior in Aztec culture was not about how many people you killed, but how many prisoners you could take, often with the intention of having them sacrificed to the sun, to which the eagle was considered sacred. But becoming an Eagle Knight was not easy, because Aztec males served a compulsory tour in the armed forces at 17, only graduating to manhood once they captured a living prisoner. It meant that you had a lot of competition. To even be eligible for becoming an Eagle Knight meant capturing, at the very least, 4 prisoners of war. Eagle Knights had their very own special temple too, which was carved out of bedrock up on a hill next to the ruler's palace, which is essentially an eagle's nest. Their entire life centered around and was devoted to non-stop fighting. They even acted as the police.
Yeah, so they were like badass elite knights.
Eagle cops. I didn't know they had eagle cops outside of Nazi Germany, but there you go.
Dude, if we had the Eagle Knights on our side, it would have been over in like 2 weeks.
Yeah, we'll out-eagle the eagles.
Yeah, it's going to be an eagle free-for-all.
Okay, so I think it's worth noting here that any Aztec warrior that died in battle or sacrifices to the Aztec god of war, will, sun, and fire, Huitzilopochtli, they were called Guahutecia, or the Eagles people. I think I have that pronunciation wrong because spell check, but this association with war and fighting was directly related to Huitzilopochtli, and he is the eagle that you see on the flag of Mexico.
Oh.
I'm going to talk about that much later, unless I should talk about it now.
Let's talk about it later, but keep these ideas in mind when we talk about the way of the eagle as time goes on. All right, so what about snake cults? Is it as sexy as it sounds? Well, the one that stands out the most is probably the Ophites, who are an early Gnostic Christian sect. What we know about them comes from Hippolytus, a 2nd century bishop of Rome. He described them in his now lost Syntagma, which was written in 220. And then later, Pseudo-Tertullian, likely possessed of a Latin translation of this lost Syntagma, taught of the Ophite beliefs as thus.
Christ did not exist in the flesh, that they extolled the serpent and preferred it to Christ, and that Christ imitated Moses' serpent sacred power, saying, "And just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up." In addition, Eve is said to have believed the serpent as if it had been God the Son.
I like this lifting up of the serpent off the ground and that last line there that Eve said to have believed the serpent as if it had been God the Son. She's kind of not wrong there, because the Hebrew speaking people who wrote the Bible, they don't believe in a separate God-like force that is the devil or evil. It's all God. So she's not wrong in the original tongue of the people who wrote this story. She's not wrong to say that the serpent is the Son of God, because it is. They didn't believe in a split between the two forces, so she's not wrong.
Correct.
And then others who wrote about the Ophites, like Epiphanius, he taught that the Ophites did not necessarily prefer the snake to Christ, but considered them identical. The idea that Christ may have been the serpent in the garden is a compelling idea for reasons we shall soon discuss. For myself, I find this a compelling idea because from an esoteric perspective, and even according to mainstream Christianity, Christ and the serpent have an intimate relationship. If the snake never tempted Eve, then Christ would never have been needed to be sacrificed upon the cross to redeem humanity's debt. Did God have a plan or not? Is he omniscient or not? If he is omniscient, then the serpent in the garden and Christ are merely two sides of the same coin. And as we've mentioned on the show before, the Hebrew language is composed also of numbers. And the same numerical value of 358 applies to the word serpent, Nahash, as it does Messiah.
This is true.
So even the Hebrew language agrees that there's a corollary.
Yeah, it's Christians who freak out over serpents and stuff like that.
Snake.
So there's a pretty good quote that Reinstall Paul said in his presentation. He said, "The serpent knows what the eagle can never understand. The serpent knows that no matter how hard the eagle tries, it could never truly become a god in its own right." So if we put ourselves in God's perspective here, there is no difference between both the snake and the eagle. Both are lower than the god itself. The snake knows this, but the eagle is too caught up in its own thought or ego to even tap into any sort of hidden knowledge or awareness to even realize that they are still animals. That is, if we take these archetypes to their extremes.
Okay, but what about the Pixar version?
Well, when you take things to their extremes, they make for really good stories. So, remember Toy Story?
Yes.
Remember berries?
There's a snake in my boots.
this cowboy, you know, talking to this spaceman who's trying to fly like an eagle. So Woody knows that they are just toys and that there are a million Buzz Lightyears out there on the market for sale. The fact that Buzz is ignorant of this nature makes for a great adventure, which is somewhat of an interesting point because that's kind of what it means to even be a human in the first place, right? To have these experiences, to do stuff. You're not just a toy, Woody.
You are a toy!
It's true, but isn't there like a voice in our head that's kind of saying like, no, God, I am not just a toy. And that's what we call free will. And that's a whole complicated discussion there, of course. But that's why we're put here, to go on this hero's journey, right?
Yeah.
And so this classic tale of the hero has become bonded to the human identity. It's sort of a human right to have the ability to test oneself, to cross that abyss, to slay the dragon. That's sort of the fun part, especially if you like Dark Souls.
Oh, hell yeah.
So there's another really cool thing that Reinstall Paul said. He says at one point, humanity screwed by its own hubris. It's clear now that technology and being connected is kind of biting us in our ass, and we're looking towards more sophisticated technology to save us from the loop of like we're just like consuming media and we don't even know how to tap into the snake mentality anymore. This eagle thing has been kind of going on for a while, and we're losing our connection to nature and what it means to be human.
I think you're onto something, and I believe this is part of the meta narrative of Toy Story. For instance, we know that Pixar uses esoteric symbolism in its films. Toy Story is its big front runner film. And one thing I love to point out about Toy Story is in the first one, at Sid's house, outside of his room, you can see the floor pattern from The Shining. So besides inferring that Sid is a victim, likely at the hands of his father, we can see an even deeper narrative. And it does have to do with these two archetypes of Buzz, who of course is named after Buzz Aldrin, who landed the eagle on the moon, and Snake in My Boot Woody. Because underneath the surface, The Shining is a story about eagle-bearing, colonizing conquerors that came, wiped out the natives, destroyed their way of life, committed genocide against everyone they ran across, and founded the United States upon it, its pinnacle crown achievement being the Apollo program, with Apollo 11, the eagle, being the symbol of the entire accomplishment, the entire space program. And so you have the eagle, the way of high-flying technology, in this case, literally rocketry, rising up to the stars on the blood of the natives. That's the blood coming out of the red elevator, right? And like, I think Toy Story's playing with that a little bit. And it brings up the question, what was Kubrick on about? What is the bigger story here? Because, as mentioned prior, the eagle versus serpent narrative is attractive because it supposes that these two primal archetypes symbolize two factions, which have been competing for control over the destiny of humanity since time immemorial. As the story goes, these two factions have their origin in the gods of ancient Sumer, the first known human civilization. And if we're being honest, it treads deep into alien farmer territory, my favorite. The Sumerians referred to their land as Kingir, which roughly translates to country of the noble lords. Farmer aliens. Prior to being conquered by the Semitic-speaking Akkadians, ancient Sumerians spoke a language called Imgur, and refer to themselves as black-headed people. Nobody really knows why. Although unmentioned by the Sumerians themselves, the region, now southern Iraq, was populated initially by a group scholars call the Proto-Euphradians or Ubaidians. These Proto-Euphradians are said to have laid the groundwork for later Sumerian civilization, draining the marshes for agriculture, developing trade, and establishing industries, including weaving, leatherwork, metalwork, masonry, and pottery. In some ways, they almost sound like the Igigi, or lesser gods, who appear in the Sumerian creation myth, but we'll talk about that shortly. While the exact details are still a matter of academic discussion today, many scholars suggest the people who would become the Sumerians were originally Semitic people who came from the area of Anatolia, possibly even the Caucasus and surrounding areas, intermingling with the Proto-Euphradians, and then created high pre-Sumerian civilization with them. Some archaeologists even believe there's evidence to suggest cross-pollination with the peoples of the Indus Valley civilization.
Because we Indus, bitch.
Now, by 3000 BC, there were 12 walled cities, each worshipping a different deity, with the temple or place of worship located at the center. These deities were referred to as the Anunnaki, which means those who from heaven came, and were often worshipped separately at their own respective cult centers, with each believing theirs as the greatest and best. This is not entirely unusual, as the ancient Egyptians and even modern Hindus did and still do worship this way, often giving different mythic accounts of creation based on what what cult center is presenting the information. It is said that at first, the power belonged to the people in each of these walled Sumerian cities, but rivalries and battles between them eventually saw the adoption of a system of kingship. According to the Sumerian Kings List, there were 8 kings who ruled prior to the flood. Afterwards, a number of independent city-states vied for control but were eventually subsumed by Semitic cultures like the Akkadians and Amorites, along with the rest of their cultural practices. The Sumerian cuneiform style of writing was adapted to other languages and used fairly regularly all the way up until around 70 AD. Studying the religion of the Sumerians, and by extension their gods, the Anunnaki, it's a bit tricky because, from what I can understand as a low-level amateur historian, is that Sumerian myths, along with much of their civic practices, were adopted by the later Babylonian Empire and then even later the Assyrians, which did little to the stories aside from change a few names or emphasize different deities. Enki becomes Ea, etc. Prior to the discovery of any original tablets, much of what we knew about Sumerian myth came from Berosus, a Babylonian writer and priest of Bel, or Marduk as he's more commonly known, in the 3rd century BCE. It would not be until over a millennia later, in 1847, that English archaeologists discovered clay tablets with myths and political personages reminiscent of the Bible. That was their original goal, was to prove the Bible was historically accurate. They sort of just figured out that the Hebrew scribes stole a lot of stuff from the Sumerians. And this turned out to be a big deal. These tablets even recounted a tale of the Great Flood, which would further tantalize scholars and led to the translation of the oldest epic poem in history, the Epic of Gilgamesh. As time went on, the Sumerian creation myth was eventually cobbled together from various copies, which, in their original form, were contained on 7 tablets. After about 150 years trying to put it all together, all but some sections of Tablet 5 have been translated and match up well with the writings of Berosus. So we're pretty sure what these tablets said. Now, these tablets dated to about 2000 BC, although the story is much older because there's an inscription that's like, this is an older story. We got it from this place. And it's said to have 5 distinct parts. The birth of the gods, the legend of Ea, or Enki, his battle with Apsu, the primeval serpent myth of Tiamat, an account of creation, and finally, a hymn to Marduk, the son of Ea Enki, using his many, many, many titles. Of similar import here is the Atrahasis, an Akkadian epic from around the same time, which also outlines the story of the flood alongside the origin myths of Enki and Enlil, the protagonist and antagonist of the serpent versus eagle narrative.
According to this modern mythology, it would be these brothers, Enki and Enlil, who would propagate the 2 competing primal philosophies of eagle and serpent, the winner of whom would decide the fate of the world. Allegedly, it is a battle raging in continuity. Even now, it is a hidden history of 2 brothers separated by schism, Enlil versus Enki, the eagle versus the snake. Because these deities would continue to be adapted into pantheons of newer cultures, we can oftentimes speculate which newer deities have a correlation to be either brother. For example, one of the brothers would go down in history as Prometheus, and the other Yahweh.
Okay, so for those who don't get the connection here, because Greek Prometheus is connected to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, how?
All right, here we go. Prometheus stole the fire from heaven and gave it to mortals, effectively bestowing them with the power of the gods. This is not unlike the serpent in the Garden of Eden who, having tempted Eve to partake of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, induced the Elohim to worry that if they also ate of the fruit of the tree of life, they would become like them as gods. For this, the Elohim, or Yahweh, cast a curse upon the serpent. For the deed Prometheus did us, Zeus had him chained to a rock, according to some accounts, the Caucasus Mountains, and charged his avatar, the eagle, to chop out the Titan's liver once a day for all eternity. Livers were used in divination, and Prometheus' name means foresight. Most versions of the myth credit him with creating humans and offering us his namesake. This aside, I think there is a good comparison between Yahweh and Enlil as the king of the gods, specifically the class of whom created us in their image. Although most attributions to the pagan equivalent of Zeus or Jupiter are given to Ea Enki's son, Marduk, the patron deity of Babylonia. He's also the one who defeats Tiamat, the dragon of chaos archetype, which then, of course, recreates the eagle and serpent duality yet again. I think it's worth mentioning that Marduk is associated with Jupiter in the Sumerian zodiacal system of wisdom, so of course they're going to be cognate.
They've fought over religious supremacy and ideological superiority from one side of the globe to the other throughout the millennia of human history. Enki has been known by many names, such as Enanzu, Ea, and represents the serpent ideology. He is the bearer of dragon knowledge and the god who gifted humanity free will.
Wait, what's dragon knowledge? Is that how you talk to Godzilla?
Yes. I'm glad you asked though, Mal, because there's a whole section on that, but for now, it should suffice to say that the Gospels of Thomas are a good example. That's the dragon knowledge. On the other hand, my favorite piece of dragon knowledge comes from John Gardner's Grendel, when the dragon bids Grendel some parting wisdom.
My advice to you is to seek out gold, sit on it.
Enki's older brother, Enlil, has also gone by many names, such as we've already talked about, like Zeus, El to the Canaanites, Yahweh to the Hebrews, and he represents the eagle ideology. Enlil is the lord of the sky and the bringer of law. Where Enlil is solid with a strong foundation, Enki is flowing and adaptable like water. It's a very yin and yang dynamic. But Enlil, as lord of the sky, was given preeminence among the Anunnaki and the highest judge.
He can see all the things!
These factions have displayed their loyalties through symbolism in human civilization since the dawn of our time as a species, and they still display their factions and those loyal to them through the same symbolism even now in modern times. The rise and fall of the myriad civilizations are always in flux throughout the eternal battle of the eagle versus the serpent.
Where you from, kid? Where your grandma live, homie? Scales of feathers, son!
Now, for a couple thousand years now, it kind of seems like one side has been consistently winning over the other.
For sure in the West.
The eagle has been on a long winning streak since the victors write history. The serpent has long been demonized and dismissed in endless propaganda campaigns. So many have been forced into warlike culture to the point that it almost seems normal in the natural way of nature. Like our war culture is just how it should be. Meanwhile, the serpent knowledge has been under constant attack. However, the battle is far from over. The destiny of humanity hanging in the balance. Though the serpent may be obfuscated, demonized, and diminished, it can never be silenced or annihilated. The serpent is more subconscious and subtle. So this temporary waning still suits its nature and kind of fits to its strengths. The serpent remains regardless.
That is true. Snakes get really cloudy and almost dead looking before they shed their skin and renew themselves. Now, on the point of the serpent sort of biding its time and waiting to attack, we only have to look to the Gospels of Thomas at Logion 39, which says,
Jesus said, the Pharisees and the scholars have taken the keys of knowledge and have hidden them. They have not entered, nor have they allowed those who want to enter to do so. As for you, be as sly as snakes and as simple as doves. Not like an eagle, like a dove.
Most may be inclined to dismiss the serpent. After all, isn't it the snake who tempted Eve in the Garden of Eden and doomed humanity to an endless existence of suffering? Is it not the dragon that is always the enemy in fantasy stories? As long as anyone can remember, it has been associated with treachery and deceit, poison, and striking unseen.
You would be right to dismiss the serpent because of our cultural programming.
Yeah, it's just natural. Like, anybody who goes outside the box, what do? Demonize him, make fun of him, single him out as weirdos. But what if there is more to this story? For example, the biblical story of the Garden of Eden is not the original version of the tale, but a later evolution of an older story. The mythology of Eden originates from ancient Sumeria in the original tale, laid down in cuneiform upon ancient stone tablets. We get a different version of the myth in this allegedly original version. Humans are little more than automatons, glorified meat robots, while Enlil wished to keep humanity as it was, mindless slaves. The serpent, Enki, deified humans as demigods, bestowing upon us consciousness and free will with it. It's odd how different this version of the Garden of Eden tale is, isn't it?
What makes this tricky is that there are numerous editions and translations of these tablets. In some of the versions, like the Enuma Elish, it seems like Marduk, having just defeated Tiamat and creating the world out of her body, just up and tells Ea Enki that he will make humans from his blood and bone so that they may provide service to the gods. As it says in Tablet 6, when Marduk heard the word of the gods, his heart prompted him, and he devised a cunning plan. He opened his mouth, and unto Ea he spake. That which he had conceived in his heart he imparted unto him. My blood will I take, and bone will I fashion. I will make man. That man may, I will create man, who shall inhabit the earth, that service of the gods may be established, that their shrines may be built. Here we can see the use of bone being used to create the first humans, as later in Genesis, a rib bone is required to create Eve, who likewise is made of Adam's flesh, in the same way humans are made of Marduk's flesh.
I just want to pop in here and talk about the underlying symbolism of blood and bones. We know that blood courses through our bodies, and we have readily associated blood with life since ancient times. It's also linked to inheritance from our parents. you know, in a DNA kind of sense. So something also acknowledged across cultures throughout history, hence to be of noble blood, you know, passing down the inheritance of kingship from father to son. Blood is a quickening aspect of life, so it's related to motion and power. Or in Egypt, Sekhem, which is important when it comes to occult significance, and it also explains why blood has been used ritualistically throughout history. As we live, blood continues to imbue us with power. In ancient Egypt, blood was also related to spitting, which was a creative act, as something which may issue forth. So the act of spitting is a big symbol for the act of creation, and this is how it's often described in Kemetic mythology. This makes sense when looking at blood use in rituals, when it's used to issue forth power unto what it is directed at. For example, the blood directly from an ox's foreleg in funerary literature. Bones, on the other hand, provide us with structure, and there's likewise a hinting at mortality that we can see in ancient texts when bones are mentioned. As we know, after death, bones are often the last parts of a human body to deteriorate. We talked about this in the spontaneous human combustion episode. It's a pretty monumental task to try to deliberately reduce bones to ashes or nothingness. And alchemically, bones represent the earthly body or salt aspect of our bodies. So after death, the salt is left behind, just like in practical alchemy in the lab. And just as a couple notes also on bones, the bone hieroglyphs are used to imply ancestry and inheritance as well. Hmm. You have the backbone of Osiris, which is the Djed pillar, and he's a god of death. So it's very much related to the earthly realm. And all of this symbolism is even brought forward into the Bible. It's reflected in the story of Joseph's bones. So Joseph, in the Bible, it said that he was embalmed in Egypt. His bones were taken and they journeyed for 40 years, eventually to be buried in Shechem. And it signified the inheritance of the sacred land to the Hebrews. So I think it's really interesting. It seems to me like the Sumerian tale is implying that Marduk, as Ea Enki's son, gave us life, death, and even divine inheritance to humans.
So after Marduk suggests using his bone and his blood to create humans, there are some fragments, and it seems that Ea, or Enki, steps in to take over the process, suggesting that a god needs to be sacrificed and have its flesh and blood mixed in with the clay to imbue the young beings with the intelligence of the gods. Like Prometheus of later Greek myth, Enki is sometimes referred to as farsighted. German expeditions near the turn of the century uncovered fragments suggesting the god sacrificed was Kingu, a name that means unskilled laborer, and was a consort to Tiamat during the war between her and the Anunnaki, her children. Taken all together, this means, according to Sumerian myth, humans are one part god and one part demon, that's Kingu, just like in the Diablo franchise. Keep in mind that Tiamat, Kingu's mother, is often considered the personification of primordial chaos and the deep. She's like a big dragon. This means that humans are inherently linked to the dragon through their blood. The rivalry between Enki and Enlil, alongside their respective fondness and disgust for humanity, becomes much clearer in the Atrahasis, which, alongside another rendition of the human creation story, is the original story of Noah's Ark. But we'll get to that shortly.
So coming from this narrative, we can look at things a little differently. In a fascinating battle of the ages surfaces that is no less than a clash of gods over the soul of humanity. However, it is important to remember Enlil is just the supreme god on Earth, and not the supreme god of the Anunnaki. That title goes to Anu, who sadly had his wiener bitten off in a naked wrestling match. Not joking. Go read Zachariah Sitchin. But at least he had children before that travesty, including Enki and Enlil.
That's rough, buddy.
Brutal, yeah. Ugh. But why is the Enlil faction so eager to abolish this serpent knowledge? The Anuna venerated Enki throughout Sumerian mythology. So, this is absolutely like an inner conflict, a sibling conflict, like a conflict within a group. Enlil is never regarded as like a Satan-like figure. He was frequently revered by everyday people. So, why would Enki deserve this? And why would Enlil cultivate this grudge for so long? So much history has been lost to the human race, and those who may comprehend some of the mystery keep it veiled within secret societies. If humanity only ceased being unconscious slaves because of Enki's intercession, why would any human being stand on the side of Enlil? To be fair though, Enlil does kind of change his perspective on humanity down the line, but that's quite a ways off from the beginning of this grudge. The war in heaven is an overlapping legend across all ancient mythologies, and the heart of the conflict is held equally responsible by many gods. gods. Still, two in particular always seem to contrast to the point of inherently clashing dynamics. Again, the yin and the yang.
This then raises the question, can the Anunnaki be considered esoteric forces, or are they extraterrestrial beings? Like for realsies. Sources like Matthew Lacroix seem to think that they are physically manifest alien beings with the ability to become non-physical at higher levels of evolution. Remember, if we look to the religious beliefs popular around the time of Christ, Hebrews and Proto-Gnostics believe that the creation of humans occurred in a rarefied, non-physical dimension where they existed as whole, both male and female, in the image of God. If sources like Matthew Lacroix are to be believed, this was merely mythologizing a real, earlier edition of a perfected humankind that actually walked upon the physical earth.
The original Adamu, us, as depicted in the ancient Sumerian tablets, was unlike us humans who live now. For one, they were immortal. Not that they couldn't die, surely sickness or mortal wounds would even end at Adamu's life. But humanity in those beyond ancient times did not age past maturity. So once you were 25, I guess, if you were a dude, you never aged past that.
What sounds so good.
Yes. When do girls reach maturity? Like 16?
Oh my gosh.
You would
so
stay
great.
16 forever. Yeah. We were also more robust and resistant to contagion, unless we were killed, of course. Hypothetically, we could live forever. We're like the elves from Lord of the Rings.
I'm still mad it doesn't work this way.
This immortality humans began with really pissed off and little for some reason. It was taken away from us, and our evolution was inhibited. Some say this is represented in our junk DNA. It looks like some of it was just turned off. Our spiritual and biological potential was inhibited, and we were allowed to exist in the form we are presently. There is scientific research that suggests that our cells don't have to degrade the way that they do. Not saying that it's a natural evolutionary thing at all, just that it's not a law of science, like, say, cause and effect or gravity.
There are immortal creatures out there that work this way, where they can be killed, but they don't quite age the way we do.
Like tardigrades?
Yeah, turtles, sharks.
There's some worms that do that too.
There's quite a few creatures that have very extreme limits. Lobsters, if they could molt properly as they got older and fast enough, because of metabolism or something, they just get too big and start, you've seen weird, freaky-shaped lobsters as they get bigger. But theoretically, if they molted perfectly, they could function internally forever. And then there's like a class of life forms called extremophiles. And there's even some that live like on the very, very limits of our atmosphere. And they're like sometimes mile-long, single-celled organisms that zip around in space. It's pretty wild.
It's called Satan. Satan worm.
Yeah, and there's even some classes of extremophiles that live inside of lava. When lava cools, they've observed life forms continuing activity on the surface of the cooled lava.
Or in like the acidic and brimstone pools of geysers and stuff, with like heat that usually would kill off anything and chemicals that don't support life, like things will arise there as well.
Like Jeff Goldblum says in Jurassic Park, life finds a way.
No, you forgot the
No, he's pretty sure when he says that one.
No, he says life finds a way.
Oh, you're right.
Correct. Okay, so it's also important to remember that the Anunnaki, despite their claims, did not create humanity. They merely altered us for their own selfish purposes. While this sped up our evolution unnaturally, it had more bad side effects. Like I said already, we were dumbed down and our potential was rendered impotent. Our ability to reach higher dimensions and levels of consciousness was and is purposely inhibited. Why? Why did Enlil truly hate humanity? Or were we just collateral damage in his animosity toward his brother Enki? In any case, he really disliked us. But the Sky God had many more grudges humanity inherited through no fault of her own. Enlil eventually led the whole pantheon to agree that humanity's destruction would be preferable to suffering our existence any longer. Luckily, his plan was foiled, as Enki once again stepped up to be the benefactor of humanity and ensure our survival.
In the Epic of Gilgamesh version of the Flood, Enlil is unbelievably pissed off to learn that humans have survived the deluge. He immediately suspects another god, in this case the Igigi, for tipping the humans off, before Enki admits that it was him and chastises Enlil for being too extreme in his decision to kill all of humanity. After all, they were just being a bit loud. As it says in the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Just then, Enlil arrived. He saw the boat and became furious. He was filled with rage at the Igigi gods. Where did a living being escape? No man was to survive the annihilation, Ninurta spoke to Valiant and Enlil, saying, "Who else but Ea could survive? Who else but Ea could devise such a thing? It is Ea who knows every machination." Ea spoke to valiant Enlil, saying, "It is yours, O valiant one, who is the sage of the gods. How could you bring about a flood without consideration? Charge the violation to the violator. Charge the offense to the offender. But be compassionate, lest mankind be cut off. Be patient, lest they be killed."
Enki really does sound like Prometheus. They make Enki seem very obviously like he can see into the future, and that's why they use him as an oracle. And then Enlil, he's just some kind of dick, I guess.
Wise rulers always balance mercy and severity, yet the serpent is the one so often associated with darkness, and not the eagle. Why is this? Why are the serpent and dragon so misrepresented? The serpent and eagle ideology must be at odds. There is no room for contrast. But what is it about these ideologies that caused them to become embroiled in such an eternal conflict when opposites are so natural in existence? It is really easy to just throw shade over Enlil and go along with the many researchers that he's basically the bad guy, and this is just a simplistic battle of good versus evil. But such black and white blanket views are rarely backed up by the nuance found in most things. Polarized extremes are always bullshit, so there has to be more to all of this. It's just not easy to pull out of the bias that infects this topic. Enlil was actually friendly with the first version of humans before Enki messed with the plan. He was happy with the original version of humans in the garden. You can see this somewhat represented in the Hebrew version of the tale, where God is chilling out with Adam and teaching him stuff and telling him he has a job to do and whatnot. Enlil liked his creation. Some out there say that intelligence, awareness, and consciousness are a curse, and we were better off being like animals in a way. Some researchers, they say that the Garden of Eden tale is a metaphor for when humans evolved to have independent self-aware consciousness, and that us getting kicked out of the garden, quote unquote, was literally just our brains evolving to have self-awareness as we do now as Homo sapiens sapiens. Coming from this idea, maybe Enlil was trying to spare humans pain and suffering because we were not ready to handle that kind of burden.
That sounds nice.
It does sound a bit like what we learned about in our Terrence McKenna episode, where it sounds like the garden ended when humans realized they could have sedentary lifestyles and they had to start waking up at a certain time and working the fields and fermenting the thing and the blah, 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 blah. It just became like, oh, now we have to work by the sweat of our brow constantly. We can't just like eat mushrooms and hunt panther and by the fire. We gotta like work.
In any case, Enlil was also furious at the later interbreeding between the Anunnaki and humans, of which his brother Enki was directly guilty of a decent amount of times. He would later call them abominations and seek their utter extermination. However, that comes later.
Enki likes to f-
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this is where furries come from.
Well, Enki used to always have threesomes and whatnot with his lady human friends.
I'm starting to realize that maybe mankind has had a furry problem since ancient times, Mari.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that, like, it goes way back.
It's a hidden meme inside of all of our episodes somehow. I don't know why, but it's present.
And Lil's just like, don't f*** the pets, Enki!
Gif in hell.
Dude, Enlil has no place to talk, though, because if you know the mythology, he does the unconsensual type of sex.
Oh, he's definitely Jupiter, then.
Yeah.
Jesus.
He's R-rated.
Whereas Enki was like, he loved all his lovers. Anyway, Enlil was also the chosen leader of the Anunnaki on Earth, and he was heir to the throne. So Enki defying his orders also makes sense why Enlil was just so pissed off. I mean, it could have been like a political thing. If you think about it this way, and if politics are crazy in human societies, just think about how crazy they could get in Anunnaki culture.
It sounds like they definitely had human-like politics. Imagine you're the boss of a far-out outpost, and you're trying to manage this thing and look good. Good. Be the superior, but this one dickhead is repeatedly ignoring your direction and actively making you look like an idiot not worthy of respect. You can't fire him though, because he's your brother. And your position is actually given by both of your dads, the real boss. Thus, it's almost like Enlil is the president and Ea Enki is like the pope. Enlil calls the shots, but wisdom is the proper domain of Enki. Perhaps this is still the case, or just a very enduring meme, because plenty of people have pointed out the fish, the dragon, and snake symbolism in and around the Vatican, while eagles and government hardly need to be mentioned.
Yeah, and if, you know, Enlil wanted to save face, how could he put up with his brother making a fool of him? That's the ingredients for blood grudge feud war.
And isn't that just the story of, like, every king and pope?
Yeah, man, it gets under your skin. Here you are, the god of order and law, and you can't do either because you're being constantly sabotaged. If it were me, I'd definitely be super pissed off and make an example of that person as a warning to everyone else, brother or not. That doesn't mean I'd commit violence against my brother. Of course not. I love my brother, but that motherfucker fucker would pay. I would never forgive that bastard for tarnishing my legacy. Dick move, Enki.
So let's hop into this eagle ideology and take a look at it. I know what everyone may be thinking, but the eagle and the serpent ideologies transcend the left and the right paradigm, which is very interesting. The reason why Enlil tasked Enki to create humans in the first place was that a rebellion happened within the Anunnaki themselves. The Enuma Elish Tel differs, but that's the Babylon version. In the Sumerian version, the Anunnaki have inter-faction conflict because they were tired of working and thought the work they were being tasked to do by their rulers, Enlil, Enki, etc., was beneath them. It was decided that servants were required, and that's where humans come in. However, with the kind of work that the Anunnaki needed to be done, a certain level of sophistication was necessary, which is what gave Enki the idea to mix the Anunnaki design with the local proto-hominids.
That brings us to the Sumerian Garden of Eden story. Enlil absolutely plays the role of God found in the Hebrew Bible. It starts off smooth, then everything goes to shit.
This is where the lesser gods or Igigi come in. From the sounds of things, the Igigi are like the working class of the Anunnaki, but are described, well, closer to being slaves. At some point, they get tired of it. This is outlined in the opening sequence of the Atrahasis. Interestingly, the first line even suggests the gods in question were manifest people, or quote, men.
When the gods were man, they did forced labor. They bore drudgery. Great indeed was the drudgery of the gods. The forced labor was heavy, the misery too much. The seven great Anunna gods were burdening the Igigi gods with their forced labor. The gods were digging watercourses, canals they opened, the life of the land. The Igigi gods were digging watercourses, canals they opened, the life of the land. The Igigi gods dug the Tigris River and the Euphrates thereafter. Springs they opened from the depths, wells they established. They heaped up all the mountains. Several lines are missing here. Years of drudgery, the vast marsh. They counted years of drudgery in 40 years, too much. Forced labor they bore night and day. They were complaining, denouncing, muttering down in the ditch. Let us face up our foreman, the prefect. He must take off our heavy burden upon us. Enlil, counselor of the gods, the warrior, come, let us remove him from his dwelling. Enlil, counselor of the gods, the warrior, come, let us remove him from his dwelling.
Then they burn all their tools and they totally surround Enlil's house and they're like, hey, you little bastard, we're not doing your shit anymore.
That's kind of scary though, to imagine like an uprising of gods. It's like on a whole nother level. It's like Occupy Wall Street times a billion.
Enlil's just sitting home fapping human porn and then these Igigi show up and they're like, hey.
Hey, you see all this ectoplasm? It was a spooky ghost.
We were going to bring our pitchforks, but we burned them. Just want you to know that. Now, in response, Enki, along with his wife, gets this fancy idea to make humans to bear the heavy workload of these rebellious Igigi. The problem is, when Enki makes these servants like the gods in that they're self-aware, he calls the first batch the Adamu. When Enlil finds out, the Adamu are kicked out of the garden, just like Adam and Eve in Genesis, with Enlil furious at Enki's meddling, which gave humans their self-agency. In the tablets, it seems the sacrifice of a god is made to give these beings the god's intelligence, and is imparted onto them a ghost for this exchange. We might interpret this as giving humans a soul or a neshama, as it says in Genesis.
So in this tale, we see the eagle ideology in Enlil being represented as an ordered plan, practicality, efficiency, and sticking to what was set out to be done, while also being caustic towards randomness, creativity, and selfish impulses that go against such plans. Enlil is a by-the-books project manager who expects intended results. There's also an aloof, detached way Enlil goes about things that reminds me of an ends justify the means. He wants it done his way, and that's the way it's got to get done. And if anything has changed, he gets furious. The eagle represents domination, organization, and control, but this also means law and order.
This concept is also very reminiscent in Egyptian ideology as Ma'at being truth and order. Even though Ma'at is technically primordial, having existed in pre-creation, she's said to be born of the falcon creator god Ra, which is very much eagle-like. And then when the manifest world is created, all is subject to Ma'at, gods and mortals alike. So I think you could even think of this as also being like the laws of nature.
Yeah, but Ma'at is truth and order, like you said. However, Enlil is like deceptive to everybody.
Do it now!
Yeah, he's the opposite of truth.
But to be fair, if you told the sheep what you're gonna do, what would it matter?
He's deceptive to the other Anunnaki.
I really don't think it's all that different because Ra is also very Enlil-like in some of the scary dictator ways, you know.
Totally.
So, and Ra is what enforces Ma'at in a manifest nature. nature. Mm-hmm. So I really don't think it's all that far off.
And to add to what Hekka said, Ma'at also applies to the gods. It's beyond the gods themselves, almost.
I am a big fan of her feather.
We're all in this Ma'at situation together, if you're taking the Egypt stuff seriously.
Well, this is why I bring it up, because Enki is also subject to what you could consider Ma'at.
I mean, Enlil only really loses his cool when humans get too noisy. He probably got sick and tired of getting parking tickets on street sweeper day, etc.
You know, just like Ra had a lot of humanity wiped out by Sekhmet.
Oh yeah, she was pissed. Had to get her drunk. So the Sumerian Garden of Eden story is just an example, like kind of metaphorically, of the eagle ideology. But lots of attributes can be seen in Enlil throughout Sumerian mythology that is eagle ideology. From an esoteric point of view, Enlil, as well as eagle ideology, they easily embody the qualities associated with the left side of the brain. Analytical, detail and fact-orientated, numerical, logical, and practical. A plus B equals C. Let's get results by any means necessary. Justice is blind, after all. If order has to come through an iron fist, then so be it. The ends justify the means.
Might equals right.
Yes.
That's not correct.
Conquer!
No. But if you'd like to hear the rest of this harrowing saga, specifically about the serpent ideology itself, the serpent cults, a little bit of Hindu mythology, the cult and philosophy of the eagle, and a little bit of Benjamin Franklin thrown in there for good measure, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended format version of this episode, but every single one of our episodes going back before the 20s. But not only that, I'll send you a 5x5 high quality Big Bunny Baphomet sticker of our cover art, and you'll get the secret keys to our Discord server where everybody hits each other with squishy hammers and goes, "Wee! Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew!"